Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by BlackRock Health, providing patients with world-class clinical care and comfort, enabling swifter recoveries.
But first this morning, early next month, as you know, marks the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, which brought an end to the violent conflict in the north. However, while the agreement has largely delivered on peace, reconciliation and building a shared island together has remained a challenge for many. It's almost a year now since I spoke with my next guest, who's been praised for his ability to see the conflict from both sides. Ahead of the anniversary of the agreement, we bring you that interview once again this morning. Born and reared in County Down, aged 16, Patrick Keilty's father was shot and murdered by loyalist paramilitaries during the Troubles. He spoke of his vision for the future of this island when he addressed the Shared Island Forum in Dublin.
A shared island means challenging ourselves to go beyond our own comfort zones and what we're prepared to give up to make things better for others and ourselves. In this year of centenaries, the ghosts of the past are easy to honour. It's way easier to sing a rebel song about a united Ireland than decide not to sing it in order to maybe have one. And yet we have to be honest with each other about who we are, how we feel and why we feel it.
And Patrick Keilty joins me now in studio. Thanks so much for being here, Patrick.
Miriam, lovely to be here.
Nice to have you in Dublin.
Great to be out of the house. I mean, two kids under five. It's just great to get away. Waking up this morning and just, what's that sound? Nothing. It's nothing. No data. It's good.
It's actually great. Look, listen, many people know your story, but for those who might not be familiar with it, take us right back. You grew up in Dundrum, I think, County Down. And even though you were born during the Troubles, I think you had a pretty idyllic childhood, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, this is the weird thing about it. I think recently I was lucky enough, Kenneth Branagh asked me would I host the Belfast premiere in Belfast. And at the heart of that is really the idea there's such a fine line between things being fantastically ordinary and things changing drastically. And so to grow up in Dundrum, County Down, you're looking out at the Mourne Mountains, you have 4 miles of beaches, you've got the Gaelic pitch at one end, you've got the cricket pitch at the other end. We had a De Courcy castle in the back garden that we used to play in. And it kind of was amazing. Like, looking back on it now, and you're trying to rear lads in London and space and all of these things, Dundrum was a pretty idyllic place. And I think it was only really by osmosis that you suddenly sort of pick up little bits and pieces. I mean, Dundrum, County Down, population in the late 70s, early 80s, 500. 150 kids, 2 primary schools. Move along there, madam. Nothing to see. Nothing ordinary here. So, you know, essentially you're separated by religion. You're taught how to be British. If you go to one school, you're taught how to be Irish. If you go to another school. The idea of learning separate history, sometimes about the same person.
Different ways.
And then you realise, oh, that's the army there. You know, what are those guys doing? But it's only processing it now and looking back that you realise that this wasn't ordinary. So, oh, that's the army and that's a checkpoint and, you know, your ma's going shopping and, you know, we're driving into Downpatrick and there's a soldier, you know, pointing the gun out of his wagon. And then I suppose realising that society was different and extraordinary, but never expecting that that is going to come home to your door. Mm. So everything was a news story. Everything was something that was happening to somebody else. I mean, most of the trouble was in Belfast. So if you were in a little village where no one had been killed, no one had been attacked, the idea that that knock on the door was going to come to your house, that the police and the parish priest were going to be talking to your mother, mm-hmm. that your dad's best friend was going to be coming into school. You know, I was putting up posters for Comic Relief. I thought I was in trouble for putting up the posters. And to see my dad's best friend, Brian Cunningham, just sitting there visibly shaken. And that slow motion of you better sit down. It was one of those lines that you kind of hear in movies. You know, the headmaster says, Patrick, I think you better sit down. And you're going, what's this about? And your dad's been shot. And I remember instinctively, it was just like playing tennis. Your dad's been shot. Is he dead? Yes. Just that bop, bop, bop. And that short conversation kind of completely changing an idyllic life into something completely different.
That moment, has that ever got less terrifying? I mean, how old were you, 16?
16, yeah. So I was 16, I was coming 17. Mm. We played Gaelic football. My dad was the chairman of the club. My brother and myself were on the down minor team. We on the panel, should I say. Mm. Let's be very clear here. I was on the team the 2 years after and they lost. I was a sub on the team the year they won. So that just shows you my GAA prowess. But to go from, you know, celebrating that minor All-Ireland in December, it was January. It happened on my brother's 18th birthday. So because we were down minor footballers, sure, Jesus, we thought we were men. Sure, aren't we? We're men, aren't we? You know, we're young men. And looking back now, you realise you're only a kid. Mm-hmm. So I think processing it from a distance now is a good thing. It's something that I hadn't really... I think the human condition goes into survival mode. And a lot of survival mode, you sort of bury a lot of stuff. People maybe think that's a bad thing, but I kind of think that you have to keep the wheels turning. Mm-hmm. So looking back on it now, it sometimes becomes much easier. Like I'm chatting this morning about it is, you know, it feels part of me and I'm comfortable with it. But then occasionally you just get blindsided by something which just catches you out and you realise, whoa, I haven't really dealt with that at all.
Like what might blindside?
I think recently whenever I did my two documentaries, I went back to the North to try to tell the story of other people.
Superb documentaries. You made them for BBC Northern Ireland, yeah.
Yeah, I made them for the BBC and they also went out in England, which was a big thing. I didn't think anybody over there would want to hear anything about that story. Mm-hmm. So for them to go out there and people to actually watch them and maybe stop you and say, wow, I didn't know that, that was lovely. Mm-hmm. But I felt that I was making documentaries about other people's lives. I was the guy who'd sort of dealt with all of this and I'm the guy that tells the jokes about that and I'm the guy who's moved away and has a different life. And I think coming back and talking to a younger generation, and in the last documentary I spoke to a young loyalist protester, Joel Keyes, and I spoke to an amazing young woman called Brona McConville, who was the granddaughter of Jean McConville, one of the disappeared. And we sat down and we were talking about this idea of trauma jumping a generation. And her grandmother, she didn't know, she didn't live through what happened to her granny. But the fact that she was living with her dad and their family and they had gone through that trauma and then suddenly she was going through trauma, then, whoa, the wheels start ticking here and you think, how am I dealing with this? When I sit down James Keelty and Milo Keelty to have this chat about what happened to Granda Keelty, am I going to be fully formed here? Am I going to be, what am I going to tell them? How am I going to feel about it? How am I going to feel about the fact that I've now outlived Granda Keelty? You know, they were there a couple of summers ago. They were there in the summer. You know, they're playing, you know, football in Seán Keelty Park. You know, the Gaelic club turned the lights on there. They put new lights in. And my eldest fella, he goes, this is amazing. It never gets dark at Keelty Park. Oh. Now that blindsides you. And you're thinking to yourself, okay, how am I going to break this down here? How am I going to tell him that his granddad didn't die in an accident at work? You know, this idea of how do we tell the next generation what we went through, deal with it in a grown-up way without doing this thing which I did for so long, which was, well, sure, Jesus, my generation's job is to turn the page. You know, we're the Good Friday Agreement generation. We're the people that turns that page and hands this page to a new generation. And sure, we do that brilliant Irish thing. Sure, we'll just suck it up. And, you know, you use little turns of phrases like, almost everybody gets their touch. And, you know, and in a way, I do feel like that. I feel that my life has been very lucky. I feel I've had an amazing life with brilliant opportunities. I feel that maybe because of what happened to me and getting up in front of audiences and talking about stuff that was going on, people were in my corner. Audiences, it's something I only really worked out. This sounds really stupid. It's something I only really worked out recently. The idea of you maybe didn't have your dad, but by God, there were so many people in your corner that you didn't know. So going back to that and realizing that so many people that went through what I went through didn't have anybody in their corner. Their lives weren't as lucky as mine. That was one of the reasons why for years I didn't want to talk about this. I didn't want to get into that because people up the road would just go, oh, geez, here we go. Here's a bit of poor me. Didn't we all have a bit of that? And everybody there had some of that. You know, so the idea of wanting to talk about your own story, God, let's not do that. You know, you always do that thing where you want to deflect. And sitting down with Brona McConville, for her to say, oh, hang on here, you mightn't have talked this out as much as you think. And then that idea of, oh, hang on here, do I really want to take the foot off the cellar door and see what comes up? So I think little things like that, you know, it's never dark at Kielty Park, blindsides you. You think you're fully formed. And yet, on the whole, I feel so lucky to have had my dad for so long and to be able to look at my boys and tell them that they're his grandkids.
When he was murdered, how many of you were in the family? You mentioned yourself and then your brother. It was his 18th birthday and there was your mom. Were there many of you or were just the two of you?
So there was Cathal, my younger brother. So he was 11. Terrible age. I mean, there's never a good age for this. But so myself and John and my younger brother, we were kind of stumbling through it, trying to look after each other. You know, that idea of your mom, God, geez, I got to look after these boys and she was a basket case, you know, God love her. She was a mess for so long. We were trying to play the role of, well, sure, aren't we the grown men in the house? And, you know, I suppose patriarchal Ireland and the GAA reinforced that. Well, sure, geez, you're some great boys, aren't you? You know, you're doing a great job and your old fella be proud of you. So in a way, I think there's little things which people were trying to be helpful. We all got through it, so maybe it was helpful. Looking back on it, maybe it didn't help as much as we thought.
Why was your father targeted? I even hate asking that question in a weird way because it sounds like, oh, there must have been some reason. But why was your dad targeted?
Do I fully know the answer to that? Probably not. There was a lot of tit for tat going on up there at the time. There was a prominent Protestant that was killed in a neighbouring village. My dad was the chairman of the GAA club, local employer. Subsequently, I found out that because he was a building contractor in Belfast and he was operating in an area where there was protection money and all of these things. And you slowly but surely start to piece things together. That idea of my brother was getting to the age where he was going to go to university. My dad bought him a car. You're looking back on, why? Surely we're going to Belfast to, you know, like we're going to go into digs in Belfast and have the crack. And this car had been bought. And I did a show, must have been about 7 or 8 years ago. And a woman came up to me afterwards and she said, I thought the show was great. And I said, oh, thanks very much. And she said, my husband would love to have a chat with you. And I'm thinking, oh, God, what's this about? And she said, and there's always a great thing. My dad was a show band promoter, right? Used to promote bands with Jim Aiken and Mickey Miguel and brought Engelbert Humperdinck and Roy Orbison to the Procul Hall in Dundrum. So wherever you went around Ireland, right, it always had been, I know Jack Keelty. And it was normally, I know Jack Keelty because of show bands. So I'm thinking, like, I mean, Louis Walsh used to say to me all the time, I remember meeting Louis Walsh and Louis said to me, I'll always remember, this is how small Dundrum County Down was. He said, I always remember your phone number. He said it was Dundrum 272. Dundrum 272. The amount of times I rang that trying to get a gig for Daddy Cool and the Lollipops in Hilltown Hall. And I says, and I know, Louis. I says, and the amount of times that my dad said, if that's Louis Walsh, I'm not in. Right? So you kind of assumed that this was going to be a, my husband knows your dad. All right, my knew your dad. Went to meet him, and it turned out that my dad had decided to give evidence in a trial against loyalist paramilitaries for protection money. And there was a journalist in England, Roger Cook, who did the Cook Report, who had come in, and he had actually done a sting operation on these guys. And my dad was going to give evidence in that trial, and this man said, I was going to give evidence with your dad, and the trial collapsed. And so the minute the trial collapsed, I think was because they weren't allowed to give their evidence anonymously. So the idea of being behind a screen, the judge threw that notion out. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, wow, all right. And I kind of thought that was a story. You know, I thought, maybe is that kind of what happened as well? And then the documentary went out and I got a call from Roger Cook to say, I saw your documentary. And I said, oh, thanks very much, Roger, thinking that he'd an interest in the subject matter. He said, I knew your dad. And I'm going, ooh. And so suddenly these pieces come together that, you know, he was going to give evidence, I think, in a trial for protection money.
Courageous of him.
Courageous. Let's file that under courageous, Miriam. Mm-hmm. There's other words that potentially could be used for that, that myself and my brothers have maybe used. So the perfect storm of a Catholic businessman who didn't want to pay his protection money, was going to take on these loyalist paramilitaries. The idea that there was a tit-for-tat murder down the road, he was the prominent Catholic in the nearest village. There was lots of reasons, shall we say. But ultimately, like so many people up there, I suppose, I don't know, an innocent victim.
Did it make a difference that they did get, I think three guys were handed life sentences for organising your dad's murder? Did that bring in any way any kind of, not comfort, did it help that somebody went away for your father's murder?
This one is an interesting one, I think, in the bigger picture, because I didn't think it gave us any closure at all, because the loss is the loss. And that sort of set my mind in a certain way, well, does it really matter if anyone's caught for these things? Looking back on it now, I realise that we knew, you know, like the morning that my dad was killed, the police said this is an innocent man. The fact that people were, you know, caught for it, and the idea that sort of publicly people knew that, you know, this man was innocent and these guys did it. And so the right and wrong of that being in the public realm, I think, was probably more important than I thought it was at the time. I always used to think, post Good Friday Agreement, I was one of these people, you know, why can't we just move on? That idea of, you know, does it really matter? We're all going through what we're going through. We have to try to move this a bit further up the road. And then you realise, because it's a lovely, tidy phrase, let's move on, a lovely, tidy phrase. But the truth isn't tidy, and the truth is sometimes messy. And if you look at a lot of the families and stuff that they have gone through, they deserve the same truth that we got, even though we felt it didn't mean much to us. This is why I think sometimes when you look at the bigger politic of Stormont and progress and all of these things, that we sometimes beat ourselves up a wee bit too much. I mean, we made peace. If you look at what's going on in the world, there's not a huge amount of that actually happens where you have peace and people who wanted each other dead, you know, sit down and they come and they try to build, you know, a future. I think it's all of these things are untidy. And we have to try, it's our job maybe to try to navigate through that, you know, as best we can.
But you're remarkably not bitter. I mean, just interviewing people down the decades, as I have, who somebody, like their father has been shot, and some of them did go into paramilitary organisations because they could not get over. They were so angry, which, you know, I understand that anger. But how did you manage not to be bitter?
I don't really know. I think there's certain cliches that we have. I think cycle of violence is one. Oh, geez, there's a cycle of violence and it's bad people doing people. Well, what's that cycle of violence caused by? It's normally caused by a cycle of hurt and a cycle of pain. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that myself and all my family felt was, number one, we don't want anyone to go through what we went through. I mean, the documentary I did last year when I sat down with Jackie McDonald, and Jackie, former UDA leader, you know, the UDA were connected to the group that killed my dad. You know, Jackie's now a community worker. Sitting down with Jackie, it would be very easy to say, well, here's the white hats and here's the black hats and the good guys and the bad guys. I mean, of course, Jackie caused a lot of people a lot of pain. But nobody asked Jackie what caused him the pain to start with. You know, things don't just start. Where did that pain, where did the hurt come from that maybe then went into something else? I don't know. When you're a comedian, you're kind of curious about things. You know, you're wired to be curious. I'm curious about how people think. I think if you want to make any progress, well, you can't talk to somebody's veneer. You know, Chris Rock, the comedian, has got this great line where he says, you know, when you meet the person, you don't meet the person, you meet the representative, you meet their PR. And so that idea of, but who are you really? And why do you feel this way? Why do you feel this way is always a good question. And sometimes then that's where you get a little bit of middle ground. I mean, that's the Shirt Island speech that I did. A lot of that was driven by that, which was, we can put people in boxes and we can decide, well, you're that and you're that, and I've made my mind up. But we're all here. We're not going anywhere on this island. Who are you? What's your story? How do you feel? Why do you feel that way? I think that's important.
It's pretty exceptional, though. The problem is, I think some people, and I do understand it, can't get over the hurt. They just never can move beyond it. And then that leads to entrenched hatreds and divisions. But you have moved beyond it.
I mean, there's that great football phrase, isn't there? You know, that it's not a matter of life or death. It's more important than that. But the word in the middle is life or death. I don't see it as that. I see it as life and death. We're all going to die. We're all going to bury people. We're all going to enjoy people when they're here. And everybody listening to this morning, they mightn't have lost a loved one the way that I did. It doesn't make that they're hurt any less. How we cope every day with the light and the shade of life, people become broken because it's so hard to, so hard when the tide is out to realise the tide might come back in. Yeah, I've been lucky. The tide's come in and out 3 or 4 times. It always comes back in.
It's a beautiful way of putting it. How did the Marion Street speech come about? And for anyone who hasn't watched it, they should watch it because it's incredibly powerful. Did it take you long to write it? Why did you do it? How did it come about?
I got asked, would I be interested in sharing a platform with some other people from North and South and community groups, and did I want to talk at it? We went to Dublin Castle, and it did take a long time to write it, because mm-hmm. when you're standing in Dublin, sometimes you don't have to think about these things. Probably rightly so. Let me put that one out there to begin with. The idea that, you know, people in the South should be thinking about the North. I mean, why are you not thinking about us? Jesus, terrible. Getting on with their lives, you mad. for getting on with their lives. Maybe you should try to get on with yours. So if anybody asked me to come and talk about who I am and why I am that person, and maybe is there a message for what has happened in politics after the Good Friday Agreement, I'll go anywhere and talk about it. I think it was important for me to come to Dublin. There was this moment, the Taoiseach was speaking beforehand, so he came in and, you know, there's a press pack and they're all there in this massive room because they thought there was going to be a full audience, but then there wasn't. And so the full press pack, and he gives his speech and he says thank you and he leaves, and suddenly the room just empties. And like normally I kind of have to get on stage and tell at least two jokes before I can empty a room, you know. So the idea of like the room being empty before you're even on stage, go, right, this kind of wasn't how I expected this. So it was, I think if you're going to, I'm doing a stand-up tour at the minute. I haven't done a stand-up tour in 7 years. The reason why I haven't is because I don't think you should get on stage unless you got something to say. Therefore, if I was going to do that speech, I think you have to be honest with how you feel and you have to have something to say. And that's why I was delighted to be asked and delighted to do it.
I remember one, and there were loads of great lines, but the line where you say, "It's these aren't your exact words, but it's much easier to sing a rebel song than to not sing it."
Yeah, the whole thing was, it's that idea of, I think it's much easier to sing a rebel song about a united Ireland than to choose not to sing a rebel song to have it. I think that when you live through the Good Friday Agreement and the process and how that changed politics in the North, we were forced to get into uncomfortable situations and we were forced to see how we could live together. And that idea of someone sat down and said, guys, you don't really have a choice. Now, I think in Dublin, that's a completely different thing because people down here do have a choice. And it's a really interesting thing that if you look at a lot of people that in their hearts would like to see no border and let's call this a united Ireland or a new Ireland or whatever it is. And then they start to unpick it and they realise, oh, hang on, I might have to maybe give a few things up here, you know, or maybe think differently about something. And that little pinch point is what really interests me. The idea of you sometimes, we had the price of peace. So therefore, that idea of people, peace is so hard to make because, but when you had the price of peace, we were forced in Northern Ireland to actually go through some difficult stuff. I think the politics here in the South is starting to slowly open up. Suddenly, people are going, oh, all right, so maybe national anthem, yeah, God, okay, we're going to be able to have to, oh, no, we might have to change that. So the idea of unionists on this island being part of a new Ireland, what's that going to look like? How are they going to be welcomed? You know, when you grow up as a Catholic nationalist in Northern Ireland and you're the minority, and you look at a lot of the injustice and the things that had to be fought for up there, the idea that there would be another minority on this island that would not be treated in a different way, but looked on in a different way, you know, I wouldn't like to see that. So the shared island thing is, how does a new Ireland, if that happens, embrace the Protestant Unionist people in the north of this island? And if it doesn't, how does Northern Ireland embrace the, you know, nationalist Catholic population there and the relationship with the South happen? We're all, you know, the Mountains of Mourne are still going to be here in the morning, like no matter, you know, like Geoffrey Donaldson's from the other side of the mountain. I'm from one side of the mountain. I mean, like County Down, we had De Valera as our MP. We had Enoch Powell as our MP. I mean, when you come from County Down, you realise that there's another opinion over the ditch. You kind of have to work out how we coexist.
And you went to college with Arlene Foster, didn't you, in Queens?
I did, yeah. Arlene was at Queens, yeah. It's interesting. I I met her from a first documentary. She had brought me to a church where a lot of people, you know, in her parish had been buried and had been killed by IRA. And you could, that was a moment where you realised, this is a big thing here for this community to have come so far as they've come as well. It's never clear. That's what makes it interesting. And trying to accommodate vastly different opinions is where the challenge is.
Let's take a break. Stay with me, Patrick.
Tweet at Miriam O'Call.
Welcome back. I'm here this morning in studio with Patrick Keelty, known to you all, obviously, as one of our finest comedians. But in recent times, he's come to the attention of many outside of comedy when he addressed the Shared Island Forum last year and when he made two documentaries for the BBC about Northern Ireland. Patrick, we mentioned those documentaries. If there's an example of someone who knows a thing or two about reconciliation, it's probably a man called Richard Moore. Do you mind reminding us of Richard's story and your powerful meeting with him in that documentary?
Richard Moore, as a child on the streets of Derry, was coming home from school. There was a riot going on in and around his walk home from school. He ended up getting shot by a plastic bullet and blinded for the rest of his life. I went to meet him and we spoke a wee bit this morning about, you think my opinion on things isn't maybe an ordinary opinion compared to someone like Richard. I mean, this is a man who actually sought out the soldier that actually fired that bullet, brought him back, set up a, you know, peace and reconciliation community in Derry, has had the Dalai Lama come and speak, and or as they call him, the Derry Lama now, is what is what Richard calls him. And to see that someone's life, not just their head and their heart changed forever, you know, Richard's life, can't see a thing. And so for him to do that and to try to, you know, Charles was the army guy that shot him. I came out of that meeting thinking, whoa, okay, I'm really sorry, but I'm not interested in sitting down with anybody that killed my dad. I want society to be better for everybody, and therefore, you know, those people that did it, I hope that their lives and the lives of their families, you know, will ultimately be better and live in peace. But I don't really have any, it's not on the top of my list to sit down with them the way that, you know, Richard did with Charles. And so that's the brilliant thing about the human condition. There's a spectrum of what people feel they can do and what they want to do and maybe what they should do for themselves.
And I'm only going to mention it because you mentioned it there, so I don't want it to be unfair, but in the way that Richard met the soldier who blinded him, do you ever think about the men who murdered your father? And would you ever meet them?
I don't know. I mean, it's I don't really think I would have a problem meeting them. You know, is it, as I say, is it on my list of things that I want to do? It's not something that where I feel I need to do for closure, you know, and the idea of, sure, isn't it great, and we can all sit down and I'll give you absolution, sure, and, you know, it's forgiveness and all of these things. I mean, it's not, I don't feel that. You know, I don't feel that. I do feel that their families and their kids and grandkids should have a life and a peace and prosper like everybody else. That's why we try to make peace.
Do you think it's helped that you're a comedian? So that you had this outlet maybe for decades before you thought as much as you're thinking now about the North or Northern Ireland. That being a comedian enabled you to, I don't know, forget about a lot or put a lot out there on the stage. Did it help you grieve in a sense when you look back now?
I don't think it helped me process very much in terms of the type of comedy that I was doing. I was doing kind of satire about what was going on, like sort of politics and what was happening in my society, in my world. That has always had been my style of comedy. So I don't think that helps. I do think getting on stage and having the goodwill of people around you, that's something that I hadn't really processed. And that was like a hug, literally a group hug, because they'd gone through something, I'd gone through something. I think writing the tour that I'm on at the minute has been weirdly a lot more personal because the show is called Borderline and it's about borders and what's been happening here with Brexit and how that's changed these islands forever. I would have found it disingenuous standing up in front of an audience in England or anywhere and saying, here's what I think of this, what's going on politics-wise, if I didn't say who I was and how I grew up. So trying to write this show was much harder because I was looking back at what life was like as a kid, thinking it was great, finding out it maybe wasn't. You know, I talk about my dad. I talk about being in Blackpool and, you know, going to weird stuff like going to a Cannon and Ball show and him locking the keys in the car and my mum wanting to leave the car there. You know, sure, we'll just leave it, Jackie. You know, we'll just go to the show with the boys. And he said, for Christ's sake, woman, if we leave it here tonight, they'll blow it up. And so the idea of like having a Northern Ireland red, like just silly things that you didn't take. Oh, yeah, yeah, that's the time that if there was a Northern Ireland Reg car in England that was apparently abandoned, well, clearly it was going to be a controlled explosion. So this time around I've been processing a lot more stuff. And the fact that it's come quick off the back of the documentaries where that process of looking back became front and centre for me, at the time back then, not so much.
And when you think back now to your dad, are there particular moments when you think of him, or are there particular moments, maybe the birth even of your two little boys, that you miss him the most? I mean, do you think back on him now and what it would be like if he was still around?
I sometimes do. It's that there are certain things that I know he would have got a kick out of. I'm way more able to look back and laugh and smile about stuff. You know, whenever myself and my brothers get around, we're normally telling a story about something that went on, Irish builder getting up to bits and pieces and funny stuff that make us laugh. But able to laugh, not as a coping mechanism, to genuinely just be able to laugh. The idea of being able to say to my brother, happy birthday. Couldn't say that for a very long time because, you know, my dad was killed on his 18th birthday. So to be able to say to my older brother, happy birthday, and the two of us actually have a pint and laugh and smile and go, yeah, yeah, this is a happy birthday. You know, it's that thing of, I remember meeting Billy Connolly. I mean, I've met so many people, not starstruck by anybody, weirdly. I mean, the best night of my life was hosting Special Olympics opening ceremony in Croke Park. And if you look at, there was Nelson Mandela and there was Muhammad Ali and all of these people you're meeting them. And, oh yeah, how you getting on? Yeah, great. Billy Connolly, whenever he walked into studio and I said, hi, Billy, I'm Pat. I know who you are. You don't need to tell me who you are. And I'm like, whoa. It brought me right back. I mean, one of my earliest comedy memories would have been like whenever I was 13 or 14 and you're sitting in the car and of course there was no Netflix, you couldn't download anything. You know, my dad had Billy Connolly's tapes. And the idea of sitting in a car as essentially a kid, we're driving to wherever, we're driving a football match or whatever, and Billy Connolly's flat. Hooba! What? It's a hooba! You know, just, I look back on those little moments and I think that was good. I mean, the Thomas Markham Cup that they present, you know, for the Minor All Ireland. I mean, my dad took that cup and went up to the garage, engraved my name and my brother's name with an airline into the bottom of it. I mean, can I apologise to everybody in the GAA if people are going, what is this man's name doing under the cup? I mean, that was Jack Healy. We can laugh about that. You know, there's lots of fun. There's lots of memories. There's lots of great stuff. What happens, you makes you. It doesn't need to define you.
Well, it's been a real privilege to talk to you. Before I let you go, how is your mum? Is she doing well?
She's grand. She's keeping good. Mary Keelty up there. What's nice about being on tour is no matter where I am in Ireland, I normally kind of drive home. And so the idea of
Now, do you need any breakfast? Do you need any washing done? You're going, like, Mum, you're 83. I'm grand. You say, yeah, it's nice to get home and to let her do a bit of mothering. So,
yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough for being here this morning. Like, you're a brilliant comedian, but frankly, everything else you've been doing with your shared on and speech and your documentaries is so powerful and I think makes such a difference. Patrick Keilty, thanks so much for being my guest this morning.
Miriam, thanks so much for having me.